Please take your seats, everyone. I want to apologize for the fact that we're starting a little late and tell you it is 100% my fault. I am completely responsible, but I had to see President Talabani and the new Taoiseach of Ireland, and between the Kurds and the Irish, I think they were once joined in a genetic chain because there was almost too much to talk about. But it was my fault, not theirs. I want to announce two commitments, and then we'll get quickly into this climate change and poverty panel. First, a commitment that involves Dr. Judith Roden, who's already up here, the president of the Rockefeller Foundation, Maria Blair, associate vice president, Dr. Michael Glantz, senior scientist. The Rockefeller Foundation and the University of Colorado Foundation have made a commitment worth $1 million over the next 2 years to rebuild and enhance the Center for Capacity Building by providing a bridge funding that will allow the center to operate for 2 years while they seek permanent funding. This consortium for capacity building is really important. It allows developing countries to use science to forecast and withstand droughts, floods, and other climate-related hazards. Between 2000 and 2004, an average of 326 climate-related disasters were annually reported, affecting over 260 million people. During that time, on average, 1 in 19 people living in a developing nation was affected by a climate disaster. My notes don't tell you what really happened. This thing was defunded in the budget crunch. It was only $500,000 a year in the beginning. And I was really upset about it. Hillary called me and said, Bill, this is crazy. We're getting rid of $500,000 of something that affects people in the entire developing world. Surely there is some way that through CGI this thing can be preserved. And since one of the first things you will hear when this panel starts is that the world's poor are most adversely and first affected by climate change, I cannot tell you how important it is. We all owe these people an enormous amount of gratitude. The government of the United States should be funding this, and they stepped in to keep the scientists working, the work being done, and to protect the poorest, most vulnerable people in the world. It is a great thing they are doing. Otherwise, I don't have strong feelings about it.
Thank you so much. This is great. Thank you.
The second commitment I'd like to ask and invite up here, Archie Cox, the chairman of Barclays Capital. They've gotten a little press in the last few days. The president and CEO of CARE, Helene Gayle. Marie Staunton, the chief executive of Plan UK. Lisa Mascolo, the country managing director of Accenture. This is Barclays, CARE, Accenture, and Plan International, a commitment to improve the quality of life for poor people by enhancing, innovating, and accelerating sustained access to savings and other financial services. The partners will target and reach new customers, tailoring programs to their specific needs, giving them access to financial services they never had before. This commitment, which is worth $20 million over 3 years, is expected to provide 800,000 people access to financial services. 2 billion people on Earth do not have access to basic services, including bank accounts, insurance, pensions, and loans. I must tell you, this is particularly important to me, and I know how important this is because one of the things my foundation does, unrelated to CGI, is to try to give these services to the 28 million Americans. There are 28 million Americans, almost 10% of our total population and well over that of our adult population, who get a regular check and don't have either a bank account or any access to financial services. And today they may be glad that their money's in a mattress or under the couch, but over the long run, it is a loser. And so this is something that will have to be done if we expect to move developing countries to modern, sophisticated economies where people are empowered to take care of themselves and not waiting for the rest of us. And after all, one of the things we all want to do is work ourselves out of a job here. And this is one of the essential building blocks to doing that. So we owe our committers here a debt of gratitude. Let's give them a hand. Now, because we're late, I won't orate. I want to introduce our moderator, John Podesta, my former chief of staff, now president and CEO of the Center for American Progress. Not very long ago, we were in Las Vegas together for a conference sponsored by the Center for American Progress, University of Nevada at Las Vegas, to talk about where America should go in dealing with the challenge of climate change and the opportunities of the energy transformation going on in the world. This session will address the devastating impact of climate change on the world's poor, but I also hope and believe it will address the staggering opportunity the world's poor have to dramatically accelerate and broaden the reach of development if we have the proper response to climate change. There is this idea that basically paralyzed Kyoto, that dealing with global warming is a terrible burden that should be shouldered by the wealthy countries of the world because we're putting the most greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. That is far less than half the story. Transforming our world to a carbon-free, energy-independent, sustainable set of economies is the biggest opportunity that many poor countries have today. So we need to focus not only on the burden that will fall heaviest on the poor if we walk away from this challenge, but the unbelievable opportunity to democratize economic growth that exists if we do the right things. So, Mr. Podesta, introduce your panel and go to town. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. President. I think I'm working. Yes, mic is on. Great. Well, thank you all for attending this special session on climate change and its impact on the poorest people. We've got five great panelists. I want to give a very brief introduction, substantive introduction to the panel. Then I'm going to toss questions to the panel. First, I'd like to reiterate two sobering facts that have been referenced in a number of times in the past 2 days. And I think they pick up on what the challenge is that the president just mentioned, which is the opportunity to deal not only with the effects of climate change, but the effects of energy poverty on the world. Today, there are more than 2 billion people who lack regular access to modern energy services, 1.6 billion who do not have electricity in their homes. The lack of access to clean, reliable, and affordable energy supplies increases health risks and early mortality, and it places an increased burden on families already struggling to get by. And I think that if you think about the other sessions in CGI, the cross-cutting issue of energy, poverty, education, and health care comes to the fore. Of course, the roots of energy poverty run deeper than that. In the developed world, we've seen what the run-up of oil prices have done to family budgets, have done to people trying to buy fuel for their cars to get to work, to heat their homes. But in the developing world, I think it's taken an even more devastating toll. Consider how the benefits of debt relief provided by HIPC, which many of the people in this room worked on, are being offset by increasing price of oil, which has forced many of the countries that have received HIPC relief to divert scarce resources away from education and public health in order to meet these higher energy costs. And I think the cruel irony of those facts, of course, is that many of the world's poor who rely on the crudest forms of energy, their own labor, gathering wood, burning dung, are the ones being hardest hit by the crisis that we face from global warming. They sit in the crosshairs and are shouldering the burden of its destructive effects. The entire continent of Africa, for example, accounts for less than 3% of global CO2 emissions, but hundreds of millions of people are living there that are living there are threatened by global warming. In the developing world, particularly where people are already living on the edge, even a relatively small climactic shift can trigger or exacerbate food shortages, water scarcity, destructive weather events, the spread of disease, human migration, and natural resource competition. So we, one of the things that I've noted is that these crises are more dangerous because they are interwoven and they're also self-perpetuating. Water shortages lead to food shortages, which can lead to conflict over remaining resources, which can drive human migration, which can lead to further food shortages. Of course, helping the developed world, the developing world, excuse me, build better climatic climate change resilience will not be easy. It won't be inexpensive. The UNDP has estimated that $86 billion will be required annually. The Rockefeller Foundation is working on this, and all the people at this table are really working on it, both in the United States and in the developing world. To address these adaptation needs, of course, new and additional assistance will be necessary. But I think the President also pointed to something that is in the nature of an opportunity, which is we do have tools at our disposal to try to begin to align both the development agenda with a clean energy agenda, the Clean Development Mechanism, or CDM, designed by the Kyoto Protocol to help develop countries meet their emissions reduction goals, encourages industrialized nations to invest in clean energy projects in the developing world. The problem, in my view, though, is that the investment often bypasses the countries that need it the most. Last year, there were 850 clean development mechanism projects. Only 23 of those were in Africa. So I think to date, the CDM has been limited to too few regions and too few transformative projects. So we've got to address these consequences and the interrelationship between development and energy. And it's my pleasure to introduce our panel. We're joined by His Excellency Felipe Calderón, the President of Mexico, who assumed the presidency in December of 2006. Since entering office, President Calderón has worked to promote transparency in the country's oil industry as well as other energy reforms and initiatives to benefit the citizens of Mexico. Richard Cizik is the President for Governmental Affairs of the National Association of Egypt Evangelicals. He's on my far right, and an enormously important voice in the evangelical community on the issue of climate change. Sitting in the middle is Van Jones, president of Green for All, a national organization dedicated to building an inclusive green economy strong enough to lift people out of poverty. He's also a senior fellow at CAP. Next to him is my good friend, Dr. R.K. Pachuri. He joins us here today. He's the director general of the Energy Research Institute, TERI, in Delhi, India. And as many of you well know, he has chaired the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change since 2002. In recognition for his valuable work, Dr. Pachauri accepted the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the IPCC in 2007, which was co-awarded to Vice President Gore. And finally, Judith Rodin, who in 2005 was named president of the Rockefeller Foundation. During her tenure, the foundation has played a critical role in supporting climate change resilience for poor and vulnerable people globally. President Calderón, let me start with you. You've seen, I think, the impact of people trying to deal with this energy crisis. In the United States, there was a big movement towards biofuels as one response to both high energy prices and trying to move towards a more renewable basis and a lower carbon basis. But that had an unintended consequence in Mexico, where the impact on corn prices has led to so-called tortilla crisis. So the poor pay one way or the other. They pay high energy prices. They're paying high food prices. What lessons did you learn from that period of time? What are you trying to do in Mexico to get the development side right and at the same time try to move forward on the clean energy agenda?
Well, first, the first lesson is the good part of this energy situation related with the prices that we are facing now is higher prices of energy, the traditional energy, are the best incentives to foster alternative energy, renewable energy. And I think that I can see that in Mexico and in other parts of the world, this is the most important stage in the recent history, fostering windy energy, solar energy, and other forms of alternative energy. But the problem is when a country applies a public policy in order to promote biofuels, and in particular the decision of public policy here in the States, in order to use corn with the purposes to produce biofuel, that measure caused an impact in the poorest people, at least in my country, because combined with the crisis of prices in terms of food, the corn in Mexico rose at least twice at the beginning of last year. And as everybody, as probably you know, all the Mexican people, we eat tortilla, and it's the main food for all the people, and especially poorest people. Probably much of them is sometimes is the one single food that they can get access. So if you have the double price of corn, that causes an impact in the poorest people. Well, talking about the point you mentioned, what can we do in order to face that problem? Well, at the end, the market registered like an increment of 10% on average in food for poorest people. And what we do is we are applying a special program, so-called oportunidades. Oportunidades is it's a subsidy, it's a direct transfer, but it's a conditional transfer. It's a conditional because the requirement for poorest people is the mothers need to bring the kids to the school, the mothers need to bring the kids to the doctor, and they need to go to the doctor herself and themselves. And the idea is we are investing in human capital. So the transfer is an average of $60-$65 a year, a month, for 5 million families in Mexico, which means almost 26 million people, one quarter of our population. And in this particular moment of food crisis, we increase the subsidy by 23%. So we compensated through income for the poorest families the increment in food prices. But again, I think that the outcome of this difficult stage in terms of energy prices is that we have a tremendous opportunity to promote alternative energies and to increase the use of other sources of energy. For me, I used to be Secretary of Energy in Mexico 4 years ago, and I tried to establish the first windy energy facility in Mexico. And I found a tremendous resistance coming from the old engineers in public company, because they say that this windy energy is like a fancy idea, but it's not useful at all. So finally, we established the first 100 megawatts facility in Oaxaca, and now as president, I'm developing like 4,000 megawatts of facilities in of windy energy. We are attracting investment, and we are going to establish, we are going to receive very soon a Qcell investment, this German company, by $3.5 billion, and it will to establish the largest facility in order to manufacture solar cells in Mexicali. And finally, let me tell you that the poorest people receive the most tremendous impact of climate change. The poorest people, for this short age in terms of drinking water, for instance, is the poorest people who suffer first and all the scarcity of drinking water. When we have these tremendous, terrible catastrophes in natural terms with the hurricanes, for instance, or floods in Tabasco, is the poorest people who suffer first and all because their houses are in the worst places. They have not enough capabilities to resist the tragedy. And we need to work in programs in order to match public policy to empower to the poorest people and at the same time public policy to fight climate change. And that is the reason why we are paying a special program in terms of we have a special payment for environmental services. The landmark program is ProArbol, and ProArbol is a program in order to pay to the poorest people a subsidy or direct transfer again, but the condition is they need to preserve the forests or the woods or the rainforest where they live. So we are covering right now like 1.7 hectares in Mexico in only 2 years, and we are benefiting 7 million people, and we are solving at the same time their poverty condition, and we are fighting climate change. We are stopping the devastation of forest areas in Mexico. We lost last decade like 350,000 hectares per year, but last year we got to recover, but reforestation, commercial plantations, conservation of the soil and others, we got to recover 500,000 hectares. So it's the first time in years that Mexico is recovering more land than we used to lose due to several causes. So that's my idea. The poorest people are the people who suffer more than others the impacts of climate change, as you were mentioning. And there are public policies able to solve both problems at the same time. And that's what we are trying to do.
Well, let me stick with that theme and turn to Dr. Pachauri. There seems to be an apparent dilemma between the high rates of growth that are needed to lift people out of poverty and the problem of climate change. We see it certainly currently today in China, where we have high CO2 emissions going up through the industrialization process. People have focused on India and the trajectory in India where you live. Is this a dilemma or is it an opportunity? Can we achieve the high levels of growth necessary to meet the Millennium Development needs and at the same time pursue a clean energy path?
Well, I think we need to be realistic about this. One certainly would look for opportunities, and in fact I'll mention a specific program that we've launched that I believe has enormous potential to ensure that people in rural areas living in poverty move on a path that would be sustainable. But it seems to me that in the initial period, if one has to provide infrastructure, industrialize, and at the same time provide basic services, we really don't have too many choices but to use fossil fuels. Now, it would be totally wrong for, I believe, any developing country to move along the path of the developed world, because I'd like to quote Mahatma Gandhi when he was asked whether he wouldn't want India to reach the same level of prosperity as Britain. His response was, it took Britain half the resources of this planet to reach its level of prosperity. How many planets will India require? So, you know, I think for our own national and local reasons, we need to come up with a path of sustainable development whereby we don't plunder the resources of this planet. Now, I might also emphasize that if we had a sustainable pattern of development, then the impacts of climate change can be withstood much better. Wherever you have a society, I mean, we've seen that in New Orleans, Louisiana, when Hurricane Katrina hit that society, which I might say is not sustainable. There's just so much of disparity between rich and poor. The poor were just left behind. And I think in a country or countries where you have a large number of poor people, you really don't have a choice. You've got to ensure that disparities are reduced. And to bring about a reduction, you would need to consume larger quantities of energy. And I might mention, just for the information of this distinguished audience, if you look at the case of India, our emissions per capita are about a little over a ton per capita, as compared to, say, 20 tons per capita in the case of the U.S. China is a little more than four, and they're going up very rapidly. But just to conclude on this issue, may I say that it is entirely in the interest of the developing countries to fashion a new path of development which is sustainable. Now here I want to mention one major program that we've launched, and you rightly mentioned, John, that we have 1.6 billion people in this world who don't have access to electricity. Now, we could wait for electricity to reach them, and in the case of one state in India, if you carried out a simple extrapolation, it would take 243 years for everyone in that state to get electricity. But a lot of these people are living in darkness. Once the sun goes down, they have a feeble candle or maybe a little oil lamp, which is terrible because it's also polluting apart from being totally inadequate. We have launched something called Lighting a Billion Lives. We've developed solar lanterns and solar flashlights or torches. And in fact, I've got only three of them over here, which I'll present to three of the panelists. You have one already. I think you really need to think out of the box. You've got to use technology in a manner that ensures conservation of natural resources and yet meets the needs of the people. And I'll just take a minute more to tell you how this is working. We've got several villages in India where we mounted this program. We're going to extend it to other countries as well. You train one woman in the village to charge these solar lanterns, and you provide a solar panel on the roof of that house. This woman will charge the lanterns during the daytime. In the evening, she rents them out to all the villagers. She earns an income for that. And the villagers themselves are happy because some of them may be carpenters, they may be doing some other handicraft work. That extends their working hours. You can run adult training schools and so on with this lighting. And frankly, it costs next to nothing. You need upfront capital, which I think we can find innovative ways by which we can make available. But the total cost of giving 1 billion people in this world lighting in this manner would be little over $20 billion. What is the cost of the Iraq war? It's about $12 billion a month. So, you know, 2 months of no fighting, I'm not saying it will translate into lighting for everybody, but certainly you can draw your own conclusions from that. Thank you.
Thank you. You talked about the effect of this on poor people in India. Let's bring it home to the United States. Van, you work at the intersection of the green and the civil rights movements, and you're working in poor communities that are hit hardest by high food and high gas prices, job loss. How do you get people interested in this topic? How do you get them to focus on, do you talk about climate change? Do you talk about the effect of that might have on their communities? Or why don't you describe the strategy that you bring to bear to try to do in urban communities in the United States what Dr. Pachauri is talking about doing in rural communities in India?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm just honored to be here, honored to share the panel. Mr. President, honored to share the panel with you. I have found that in trying to talk with people in urban America, if you try to talk with them about the planetary crisis, they very quickly start telling you about their personal crisis, and they are not interested. In fact, they often will say, once you finish talking about all the bad things that might happen because of climate change, they often will just say, well, Jesus is coming back. It's the end of the world. It's the end times. There's nothing I can do about that, and they just go back to their lives. So we found that when you're talking to people who already have a bunch of crisis, the most important thing you can say to them is not about the planetary crisis, but about the opportunity, the very things that President Clinton was talking about, and frankly that you put out so well in the Green Recovery Report that was just issued by Perry and by the Center for American Progress. That report spells out our basic message. If we're going to beat global warming, that means we're going to have to weatherize in the United States millions of buildings. That's thousands of contracts and millions of jobs. We're going to have to put up millions of solar panels all across this country. Thousands of contracts, millions of jobs. We're going to have to build wind farms, solar farms. We're going to have to manufacture all that stuff. Each wind turbine has 8,000 parts in it. Each wind tower, 20 tons of steel. You could put Detroit back to work making wind turbines as opposed to SUVs and fight pollution and poverty at the same time. This is an agenda that we feel can get people excited. But it sounds kind of pie in the sky at first. Luckily, there are places where this is actually happening in the United States right now. In Newark, New Jersey, we have a hero with us, Baye Adolfo Wilson. Will you stand up, Baye? Baye, stand up. Give this man a round of applause. He's taking forward these solutions and these ideas in some of the toughest communities. Thank you, brother. Some of the toughest communities in America. very simple. There's a housing crisis in urban America. When you want to begin to build, you automatically think, well, you can't do green building in urban America. It's too expensive. To the contrary, if green building means building with less toxic materials, energy conservation and water conservation in that building, you actually are building something that is more cost-effective over the long term for low-income people. Baye has brought that solution to Newark, and he's employing, through his Green Cap program, folks who didn't have jobs, who didn't have a future, who didn't have hope, and getting them connected with the work that most needs to be done. Now, this initiative got started here last year at the Clinton Global Initiative. Amy Christensen, Bracken Hendricks, a bunch of people worked together with Cory Booker to launch this initiative, and already differences are being made. I believe that we can bring a message of hope and opportunity to people who have not had it in this country for a very long time. I think we can build a green wave in this country that can lift all boats. And this is a politics that's good for low-income people, but it's good for America across the board. If we are going to beat global warming, we've got to weatherize the cities. We've got to, as Majora Carter says, green the ghettos first. Why? 75% of our greenhouse gas problem is our cities. Trucking the food in and out, leaky buildings, the transportation. So the solution for global warming is to bring the tools and the training and the technology into our cities, invest in our cities, green them first, and in so doing, you can begin to green America. And that's why on Saturday, last point, people across the United States are going to be standing up for something we call Green Jobs Now. We thought 3 months ago when One Sky, which is a brilliant climate solutions organization led by Gillian Caldwell, who's right here, Al Gore's organization, Energy Action, the youth movement, came together. We said, we want to get 50 communities, Indian reservations, black churches, folks in Appalachia to stand up and say, we want green solutions. We want green jobs. Give us the tools. Give us the training. Give us the technology. Let us put solar panels on our grandparents' home. Let us give our young folks jobs. We're tired of going to funerals. We said if we could get 50 communities to stand up and do that, it would be unbelievable. On Saturday, not 50, not 100, not 150, 600 communities in all 50 states will be standing up and saying, we want green jobs now. We want to be a part of the climate solutions movement. We want to be a part of expanding the coalition for climate solutions, fighting pollution and poverty at the same time. It can be done. It can be done. Here in the United States, it can be done.
Judith, let me turn to you. You've taken the foundation and turned it into the direction of understanding that these effects are already built into the climate. That we can do a lot to mitigate the future problems. We can do a lot, as Van just so eloquently demonstrated, to create new green technologies. But we also have to create resilience and adaptation. And you're doing that both in the United States and you're doing it globally. I wonder if you would. And I would say I think it takes some courage for people in the United States to say, to get to the issue of adaptation because so much time is spent trying to reduce carbon emissions. So tell us a little bit about the strategy. What programs are you implementing and where have you seen success?
Well, I think it's critical. We have so much energy in this room, as the speakers have already embodied, focused on the absolute importance of mitigation strategies, or we will all lose out and our future is doomed. But one of the extraordinary conclusions of the IPCC report was that climate change is already with us. It has occurred. We're seeing it around us all the time. And so how do we build in what is called adaptation? But for us, resilience strategies, because resilience is a poverty reduction strategy. Vulnerable people live in vulnerable places. The 700 million rural poor who are living on less than a dollar a day are living in the most degraded ecosystems, a lack of fertility in the soil, subject to drought. The snows stop in Kilimanjaro, and half of East Africa has a drought. So these are happening today. They're happening in the United States, as we see them as well. So it's a developing world problem, but it's also a developed world problem. There are, for the rural poor in the developing world, development poverty reduction strategies that are critical. We need to build in better agricultural strategies, drought-resistant seeds, water management strategies, soil preservation strategies, reducing desertification. All of these things are absolutely critical. They are not expensive. They just take attention to integrating adaptation to climate change strategies with the strategies that are related anyway to resource management and rebuilding the ecosystem. The livelihoods of these people, the lives of these people, depend on adaptation strategies. Take another as we talk about policy solutions with regard to this. There was not in Kyoto an agreement reached about terrestrial sequestration of carbon and giving credit for that. So as we think about the run-up to Copenhagen, we need to understand that for the developing world, agriculture, agroforestry, forest practices in general, reforestation, preventing deforestation, and giving credits for this are going to be incredibly important in the agreement. So as the other elements of the agreement are reached, if the developing world is left out because these agricultural and forest elements are simply not considered, then we're really preventing the integration of our poverty reduction and our climate change strategies. You talked about cities, Van. In the developing world, where 80% of the urbanization is going to occur in the next 10 years, 80%. About half of that is going to happen in the most fragile ecologies imaginable. How do we think about those cities and building in now the kinds of resilience strategies? Again, they are not expensive. It is not about money. Take the city of Durban, which is a very resource-constrained city. They have built in magnificent resilience strategies. They look at the weather predictions. They will have drought and greater heat than they have had in the last several decades. So they are now developing water catchment collection areas to prepare for the drought. They have a very high HIV population. So they're preparing cooling centers where HIV-positive people can come in times of high intense heat so that they're not at health risk. The health risks that need to be considered when we talk about resilience and adaptation strategies in these urban areas where people are jammed together. These aren't cities with picture postcard skylines. They're places with enormous slums and tremendous poverty. So that's why we became so compelled with the adaptation strategies. And just like this panel and the greater recognition of the fact that climate strategies and poverty strategies don't have to compete with one another. So, too, I think there's greater agreement, but there still needs to be greater agreement on the fact that adaptation and resilience strategies don't compete with mitigation strategies, particularly as we put the circle squarely on poverty and poverty reduction as part of this. The one element, Van, that you didn't mention in the United States, as we talk about all of the jobs that are going to be created, is to think about our transportation infrastructure. Our general infrastructure, obviously, is falling apart. Our transportation infrastructure at least gets reauthorized every 5 years. And so as we look at the transportation bills and we think about what a sustainable, environmentally sensible pattern would be for the United States. It certainly isn't rewarding the states for the number of vehicles mile traveled, which is how we now allocate our dollars. So let's think about sensible, environmental, sustainable, and equitable transportation policies as we think about money that will be allocated and how it can, again, create win-win jobs, climate sensitivity, equity as we go forward in the United States as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to get Richard into the conversation, but before I do that, I would like to get President Calderon to actually react to what Judith just said, particularly because I'm looking at Rory Reed sitting in the front here. Our Southwest desert is going to have a terrible water problem coming in the future. Your northern desert with a terrible water problem, shared water problem in the future. You said you were the Minister of Energy. From the agriculture perspective, Do you think Mexico is prepared for what is likely to happen when the Sonoran Desert begins to dry out?
It's absolutely clear that not only Mexico, I even think that the United States is not prepared for what is going to happen in the future. We have some difference in terms of income, but anyway, the problem is common. And the idea is, I absolutely agree with Judith, is we need to build right now the solutions in terms of water scarcity, for instance. We need to orient the community toward not only mitigation but also adaptation. That would be the case of several communities in Mexico. And let me tell you that we're facing a tremendous problem, even in political, internal political issues. Why? Because the type of development that we had in last century was totally oriented to the old agricultural practices. So we have several areas of Mexico in the north, and in the north especially, where the fields of water are completely depleted. So it's impossible to deal with this, but with the incentives that we have today, we are taking the water from the soil, and we are threatening the future for the whole community. And the interests around these agricultural producers are avoiding to take the right measures in order to correct that. But let me go forward, and I agree with other point, which is how can we finance the mitigation or adaptation measures? And my government is proposing to create a world climate change fund, a green fund. And it's a fund that could be made with the contribution of any single country. Of course, every single country could give according to our own capacity, probably a proportion of GDP or according to each emission per capita or according to income per capita. And with this green fund, every single country could withdraw from it in order to finance mitigation or adaptation measures. Because I can see that the Kyoto Protocol mechanism to finance the problem are not enough. They are not working at all. And we need for next year Copenhagen meeting, we need to create a new mechanism to provide funds, especially for developing countries, in order to change these practices in agriculture, in order to mitigate emissions, in order to renew the performance of the energy consumptions, in order to prevent deforestation, in order to reforest. That is the idea about the Mexican program ProArbol. We are paying environmental services to the poorest people. But if we can organize at a global level a green fund, with an agreement for all the countries, we can start to finance, and for me it's crucial, the economic incentives to start a new era. The problem of the Kyoto Protocol is there are not mechanisms. There are not economic incentives to reverse this situation. We have lost a lot of time. We have no more time at all, and we need to go forward. With this kind of mechanism, I want to break this old idea that developing countries are too much poor and we have nothing to do with climate change. It's only a question of rich and developed countries. I'm not agreeing with that. I think that every single country could provide some part of the help, some part of the solution, and maybe we can design a green fund according with the capabilities, common but differentiated responsibilities of every single country, we can start a new era with a new model of economic financing system with this green fund to reverse the impact of climate change.
Thank you. Let me get Richard into the conversation, and then I'll come back to you, Pachi. Well, Richard, you've done a remarkable job of highlighting the importance of climate change in the religious community. I think that You've gotten some pushback by some of your peers, but I think
really
you've
by the way, I was
begun
just
to
in,
build a,
I was just in Colorado Springs.
Begun to build a consensus.
Oh, I'm building a consensus. I'm for building a consensus.
Well, across the whole spectrum. You've also, I actually want to ask you a question. You've also been involved in working on extreme poverty and working on Darfur. Does the issue of climate change really resonate, particularly in the evangelical religious community? I mean, obviously the religious diversity in this country is great, and there are people across the spectrum. But in the evangelical community that you work in, does climate change resonate the way extreme poverty in Africa, Darfur, the other issues are?
Not yet. But it is, as your former bosses want to say, President Clinton has said, when the evangelicals in America that number 100 million decide that poverty and climate change are integrally related, when they get that picture in their heads, he said, then the whole picture politically in America will change. By the way, do I get one story? A man is driving in his Jeep Cherokee over hill and dale. He slams on his brakes, walks over to the shepherd, and he says, sir, he says, if I can tell you how many sheep you have, can I have one? And the man, totally dumbstruck, doesn't know what to do. He says, well, yes. So the American goes back into his Jeep, gets on GPS. In my world, we call that God's positioning satellite. And in a moment, he has a ream of papers. He walks over to the shepherd, and he says, you have 1,638 sheep. The shepherd says, that's totally amazing. How did you know? Can't believe it. Go pick one out. He did. He got into his truck, was driving away when the shepherd walked up to him and knocked on the window. And he said, sir, he says, if I can tell you what you do for a living, can I have my sheep back? And the dumbstruck American says, well, of course. If I can tell you what you do for a living, can I have my sheep back? And the shepherd says, sir, he says, you are a consultant. And the American says, well, how did you know? And the shepherd says, you came into my world about which you don't know nothing. You answer questions I've not ever asked. Leave out, charge me a lot of money. He says, lastly, you don't know diddly squat. You took my sheepdog. Now, we Americans, we need a cognitive reframing. And I'm in a totally different world from these other scholars, activists, and leaders, extraordinary leaders in every regard. But here is the fact of the matter. We have, and I am a governmental affairs type inside La La Land, inside the Beltway, and we have, you see, one party that has not owned up to its responsibility. And when you have 4.5% of the world's population contributing to over a quarter, isn't that right, Dr. Pachauri? A quarter of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, you have a terrible moral problem. And when you have the interlinkage, you see, between global warming and poverty, and then the social and political distress that is accompanying the other two, you have to conclude, you see, that there isn't a decision we make as Americans, consumption or production or otherwise, that doesn't have a moral component. And I happen to believe you have to change the Republicans, and since my community is over half of the conservative coalition, if you can change this community of evangelicals on this issue that is a moral and a spiritual issue to do something about the poor, then you can persuade them to do something about the climate legislation, which has literally gone nowhere in 8 years. Now, aren't leaders supposed to lead people from where they are to where they ought to be? But we've not had that in 8 years. And we need to have that now. That's what this election is in part about. But to move people, particularly Republicans, from denial, look, you don't move people by, you can't just say they are bullheaded, you know, they are ignorant or they're denialists. You can't say that. They are that. I mean, they are that, too. But you have to move them from indifference, you see, to deliberative, to doing, designing, doing, and then defending that change of thought. So they go from literally, we'll have to change Republicans who are indifferent, essentially saying, I won't change, to I will change, which is designing, I will change, and then doing it. That's doing, I am making it happen, and then I'm going to defend that decision. There is no done. But see, moving people from that end spectrum to the other spectrum involves, I believe, changing, you see, the core philosophical assumptions. And this is very deeply held. And you don't do that, you see, by calling people names, although I'm inclined to do that plenty of times.
Well, they call you names, too.
They call me names, too. But, you see, people, every one of us, you see, knowledge is power. Self-knowledge is even more powerful. And when we understand ourselves enough to know that we move, you see, in this world between our highest desires and aspirations and the way we really live, you know, actual conditions. This is kind of the spiritual realities here. When you move people from actual conditions to where they should be and where we ought to be as a nation, as a people, as an American, when you get them to make that change, you have to create to some degree tension so they will move from the one to the other. They won't move without, first of all, tension between their stated condition as they understand it and what their aspirations are. They have to have tension. There has to be a disturbance. So we are disturbers. You get plenty of flack. Every one of you, Van, Judith, every one of us, the president, we all get criticism. You get criticism. I'm challenging you to leave this room, you see, to be spokespersons and disturbers about moving people from their acquiescence, you see, the status quo, to activism, recognizing, in fact, that when you create that disequilibrium, you force them to change. That is how movements in this country happen. And secondly and only if they understand that when they make that decisional change in the way they think and the way they act, they believe the change they are making will in fact result in something different. That's the critical. They have to believe that it will make a difference. But I believe, you see, you have a country that presently in this nation, I was talking with the president of Intel the other day, and he said, well, how can it be that you have Republicans on the Hill who have the same percentages, about half, 50%, who believe this climate change is human-induced? And, you know, how can you have the same reality between those Republicans and these evangelicals? And I say, because the evangelicals haven't changed the Republicans. And they're thinking on this, and you do that, by the way, a strategy, but vision without a strategy is an hallucination. Believe me. We're talking strategies here. And you build partnerships, bridging outward, and we're doing it with scientists, the Harvard Center for Health and the Global Environment, for example, and with Muslim leaders. We recently held a consultation in Washington with the World Bank on this subject. So 2 billion people in the world, if they were to get that, because, you see, the Quran teaches the same thing as the Bible, you know, to care for this earth, it is creation. And when we can do that and build that constituency of 2 billion people, we can do this. We can do this. And it's not impossible. But we have to believe, but we have to have a cognitive reframing. So thank you.
Richard, I think that was a very powerful statement about why these two tracks were brought together. And Van, I think you wanted to get in on this. And then I'm going to turn to Dr. Pachauri.
I just wanted to underscore the importance of us expanding this coalition. Part of the challenge is that we've been thinking about these as separate issues and as issues, period. I think that there is a new governing coalition available in the United States that we could call a Green Growth Alliance. You know, we used to have the New Deal Coalition, and then we had the New Right Coalition. These were massive interests that came together to try to get some things done. I think the best people in our business community want to solve this problem. They want to meet the world-class challenge of being able to do business in a way that actually uplifts people and the planet. But we're not giving them a world-class workforce. We're not giving them world-class subsidies or tax breaks. We have Mike Eckhart here from ACOR, who's one of the great champions for renewable energy on the Hill. He's all uphill trying to scratch for a little bitty tax breaks while other energy companies get billions of dollars. But I think the best of our business community wants to be in this coalition. I think the best of our faith leaders want to be in. I think the best of our civil rights, our environmental. There is a Green Growth Alliance out there. There is a new politics of possibility and solution and problem solving. And it's bringing these issues together that shows, I think, the best of this country to the rest of the world.
Judith?
Well, I just want to say, as a former university president, I would be remiss if I didn't also add that we've got to, as part of this Green Growth Alliance, invest in research. We have disinvested in R&D in this country. There are many of us who think there ought to be a National Energy Institute like the National Institutes of Health. We spend $3 billion a year only in research about renewables or whatever. Our innovation has been the vanguard of our economic success as a nation in the United States. And so, again, linking economic growth, our future in this era of globalization, to these green issues requires some fundamental R&D that we as a coalition need to also be supporting.
Dr. Pachauri, I want you to react to President Calderon. and his idea about investment strategies. I raised the CDM. Maybe you comment on that. And then, of course, the research topic is near and dear to your heart, too.
No, in fact, I was with President Calderon just 4 days ago, and we talked about this. It's, you know, Mr. Rajiv Gandhi, when he was Prime Minister of India, and that was way back in 1988, he got very interested in climate change. I interacted with him. And in 1989, he went to the Non-Aligned Summit in Belgrade, and he put forward a proposal that the world should set up a planet protection fund to which every country must contribute 0.1% of its GDP, developed and developing, excluding the least developed countries. Now, unfortunately, he lost his prime ministership. Then, unfortunately, he lost his life. He was assassinated. If he had come back to power, I think this would have been alive. So I fully support this concept, and I suggested to the president that we might get 4 or 5 countries together to sort of form a nucleus to get this movement generated to get this particular fund into place. But one thing I want to say in support of what Judith has mentioned, I think it's critically important to carry out research in solutions of the type that I'm going to give you, but also in terms of the impacts of climate change. You know, there's a large part of the world. Look at Africa. By 2020, there'll be 75 to 250 million people suffering from water stress, not scarcity, stress, as a result of climate change. There would be some countries that will have a decline in agricultural yields by about 50% in that country. And already there are over 50 countries in the world that don't produce enough food for themselves. Now, if this is the situation, each country, each sub-region needs to understand what the impacts of climate change are going to be. And then we must create capacity within those communities to be able to develop the resilience and the wherewithal by which they can withstand the impacts of climate change and adapt to them. I think that's a critical requirement which the world is neglecting. I'm very happy that the Rockefeller Foundation has got into this. But what I also want to say is that we must provide some education to policymakers in the developing countries, particularly the most vulnerable, to see that adaptation measures are integrated with development strategy. Because you can't do this separately. It has to be built into the whole approach by which we ensure development in these countries. So that
CDM, failure, success?
Well, CDM, I think it's too early to say. Okay. It's going through a process of evolution. And my expectation is that, yes, you're right. There again, you know, in Africa, there's been hardly any project worth its name that has made a difference. And that's largely because there's a lack of capacity. People just don't know how to develop proposals and professionally present them and pursue them. China started much later than a number of other countries, and see where they are. They've got the largest number of CDM projects being implemented in China, and that's because they have the capacity. So I think that's another issue that needs to be addressed. We need to ensure that development assistance organizations, foundations, do their bit in creating that capacity locally. Otherwise, you know, you can't have consultants flying down and telling people what to do over there.
We just have a few minutes
of the type of the type that doesn't know the difference between a sheep and a sheepdog.
By the way, it was a meeting of clergy, Jewish, evangelical Protestant, mainline Protestant, and the rest who met with Senator Warner not so long ago this past summer on the Climate Security Act, which went down on a cloture vote. But the fact of the matter is there was enough sentiment by Democrats and Republicans to keep in the $1 billion in adaptation in the Climate Security Act. That was something we lobbied hard for. It's in there. Every one of you should know it's there. When the bill comes up, and we're going to spend a year on this legislation at least, if not two, the entire next Congress, that is really important. It's really important. If we don't do that, then it'll be, I think, a black mark on all of us.
Yeah. I see you're trying to get us to wrap up, and I just... Before you do, but sometimes you've got to talk at a human level. I have a 6-week-old baby boy who I'm missing. He's really special, and he's really special such that we need a special name for him. And my wife and I decided that we wanted to name him after my greatest hero, who is Wangari Maathai. So my son's name is Maathai, and I'm sitting here missing him, And I look out in the audience and I see the great hero of Africa, Wangari Maathai. I think we have to acknowledge that we have the please stand up. Please stand up, Wangari Maathai, who is the Nobel Prize winning heroine of Kenya, millions of trees planted and love planted in the hearts of millions of people. Thank you so much for being here, Wangari Maathai. My son's named after you.
Mr. President, go ahead. So I don't think that could be topped, and I'm not going to try. I just think this has been a fabulous panel. Great leaders, great leadership, Mr. President. Thank you for your ideas.
Give me what?
And I'm going to let you
have
the final word.
One problem in developing countries is education and knowledge about the problem. So we started in Mexico special program in educational sector, and we are training 1.5 million teachers to talk about climate change and environmental issues. So we prepared this special edition for all the public schools in Mexico, and we are going to give the copyrights to Clinton Foundation, to Clinton Global Initiative, to spread this, at least in Spanish, textbook for all Latin American countries, which is really important. Education is first.
Okay. Absolutely. Let's thank all the panelists. This has really just been a wonderful panel, and I think it charts a real course for us in the future. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take the time to network.